Welcome to PsychPearl's podcast with Psychiatric Times, the voice of psychiatry. We are honored to host the Breakthrough Session, a podcast by the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University. We invite you to check out our other podcasts with experts in the field of mental health. Enjoy.
I'm Dr. Angela Coombs.
And I'm Dr. Jen Sotsky.
And you are listening to The Breakthrough Session, the Columbia University Department of Psychiatry's podcast. We are two early career psychiatrists grappling with the most pressing issues in mental health today, both inside and outside of the office, with the help of our guest experts.
Today we have a guest, Dr. David Hellerstein. Dr. Hellerstein is a psychiatrist and researcher who is currently directing a study on psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, for depression. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here today.
So, Dr. Hellerstein, why don't we start by talking about kind of what we know as a field about psilocybin for mental illness?
So, you know, it's an interesting ride because the hallucinogens have been illegal since the 1970s, and so there was a vast history of use and research on the hallucinogens that basically went into all of our unconscious minds. And so now, over the past decade, there's been a revolution of, or a renaissance of reinvestigating and digging up the sort of buried history of the psychedelics and looking at them with a lens of current psychiatric research and treatment. So it's a very exciting time, and there have been some real landmark studies for use of hallucinogens that have really surprised people in finding that they actually may work for a variety of psychiatric disorders. So one of the most interesting studies that was done has looked at use of hallucinogens for people with advanced cancer and with death-related anxiety to help them deal with that type of experience. Then there have been studies for using psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression. There are other studies with eating disorders and with post-traumatic stress disorder and other conditions that you wouldn't necessarily first think like, wow, that would be a really good thing to treat with a hallucinogen drug.
Right. So maybe we could start by just hearing a little bit about how you think it might be working for different conditions, or particularly the studies that you mentioned.
So the hallucinogen drugs are derived from many different compounds. So there's psilocybin, it comes from mushrooms. There's other compounds, ayahuasca, which is a combination of two different plants that are found in the jungle in Latin America. There's drugs like mescaline and other drugs as well that come from plants. There's drugs that come from reptiles, toads, and so on. So there's many different sources of drugs that have hallucinogenic effects.
Wait a second. What comes from a reptile or toad?
There's a DMT derivative that comes. It's if you look up the doing the toad or
right.
the toad kind of thing, it's a whole little subset of the hallucinogen.
You just can't lick the wrong toad, right?
Do not lick the wrong toad.
Okay.
Right. So, but that's not what we're studying. But there's a number of these compounds. And if you look at psilocybin, is found in a type of mushroom, several types of mushrooms, and in the body, if you take a mushroom, it's metabolized into something called psilocin. Psilocin is a chemical that, if you look at the structure of it, is really fascinating because it looks like serotonin, which is a chemical in the brain and in the body that has many, many different functions for every living creature, except it has a side chain in the wrong place. So psilocybin or psilocin goes into the body. It binds to serotonin receptors that are used to having serotonin bind to them, except it has this little side chain that's sticking out in the wrong way. So to just put it mildly, all hell breaks loose. So the classical hallucinogen drugs like psilocybin and LSD have a very strong effect binding to a particular kind of serotonin receptor. And they seem to do similar things, which is setting this cascade of weird signals off in the brain. And so people will describe many different kinds of experiences that are out of the ordinary. They have a trip, right? It is a trip. I mean, they have auditory, they hear things, they see things, they have perceptual changes. They'll look at a grill of a fan and in the ceiling, it's like, wow, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. They'll have altered physical sensation, sort of hypersensitive sensations in their body. They may have very strong emotional reactions and sort of reliving early experiences or traumas in an extremely intense way. And also, people often have a dissolution of them of their self, which is can be described as a sort of going to heaven kind of experience or a near-death experience. And these are way out of the ordinary kinds of experiences for normal life.
So you have these kind of really unusual experiences, and then afterwards something has changed for people with depression?
Right. So that's kind of the question. Is this just a wild ride, or is there something actually changing in the brain? Because there's many times you'll have an experience that's really exciting, and then you just go back to your normal life. And there's studies that look at the connection of circuits in the brain, both during and shortly after the psychedelic experience, and then several weeks later. So it looks like initially many of the system's activities gets decreased a lot, and then if you look over time, some of the brain connections that were very strong and strongly overconnected in a way become disrupted. So, and new connections, new circuits seem to become activated. So, and we're in the infancy of really understanding this, but that's a very quick sketch. But the if you look at a lot of psychiatric disorders, the way that psychiatrists and psychiatric researchers are looking at them now, a lot of disorders that really plague people are related to circuits in the brain that are hyperactive and hyperconnected. So the circuit, the activity of the circuit becomes overactive and reinforces itself, and it's really hard to break the circuit to change one's behavior. So people with addiction have circuitry that is out of control. The circuit is feeding itself even if it hurts the person in their life. Eating disorder is the same thing. The circuit of eating or dieting or vomiting for people with bulimia is out of control, and the person's life becomes really, really awful. They may even die because the circuit of the brain has its own kind of fixed activity. And this is seen in depression, too. There's circuits called the default mode network, which are thought to be related to negative thoughts, especially about oneself. So a person who's depressed would, you know, I'm such a bad person, I'm a failure, my life is over. And those thoughts are reflected by circuits in the brain in the default mode network that are reinforcing even if the person's life is out of control. So that the psychedelic drugs, the thinking is, by coming into the serotonin system, causing these strange experiences physically and mentally, disrupt these circuits and may allow some development of new circuits, sort of enhancing what's called plasticity, or the brain's ability to connect, make new connections and alter its activity. And so that's really the fascinating thing for many of these different disorders that don't really seem to have a whole lot in common.
All right. I wonder, what do we know about the sort of elements or components that can go into people having a more potent experience, or like you put it, a more increased likelihood of disrupting, you know, reinforced circuits?
So I think these are very powerful drugs. And so one wants to enhance the possibility or probability that the person's going to have a positive experience and a supported experience. So the experts in psychedelic medicine, which has really many decades, even having gone underground for decades, many decades of experience of users and shamans and gurus and therapists and clinicians of all different kinds have come up with the idea of having particular kind of framework for doing the trip. So they could talk about set and setting. So it's the having a supportive environment, a comfortable environment, not chaotic, and having experienced guides to help people through those experiences. And so that's a key part of doing studies with these drugs, because they're very powerful, and people who have psychiatric symptoms and disorders are suffering a lot. So if you just gave them these drugs without a lot of oversight and support, it could be really, really dangerous, because people can have bad trips. And everybody's read or heard about people having bad trips, and in the context of being out of control, doing things that could be dangerous to themselves.
I'm just wondering, you mentioned addiction before, and it's a little bit kind of contradictory that we're using a, what's still, I think, an illegal drug, right, to treat addiction. I'm just wondering a couple of things. Is it possible for psilocybin to be addictive, or the other hallucinogens, or what do people think about that?
So it's really interesting. There definitely are people who are enthusiasts for using psychedelic drugs, but the psychedelic drugs don't generally meet the criteria for what addiction is, which would be needing more and more to have the same effect. So it was called tolerance, physiological dependence, withdrawal, other kinds of things that we see all the time with people who have alcohol or opiate or other kinds of addictions. And actually, one of the really interesting things, and I've talked to one of my colleagues in this work, Dr. Elias Dockhar, is in the Substance Use Disorder Division here at the Psychiatric Institute, and we've talked a lot about the really amazing thing and intriguing thing about the psychedelic drugs, which is people who use psychedelic drugs who have a history of using other drugs and abuse or dependence on other drugs, after they've used psychedelics, use less of those other drugs of abuse. And so if you look across the literature, the research literature on drug abuse and drug dependence, if you're a person who has an alcohol abuse problem and you start using cocaine, you're going to use more alcohol and more cocaine. Even if you smoke cigarettes, if you drink alcohol and smoke, you're going to smoke more and drink more. So it's a combination that tends to increase use. If you have drug A plus drug B, the combination of those two is going to generally increase the use of both of them. And the strange thing about the hallucinogens is people who use hallucinogens who have a drug abuse problem tend to use less of the drug they're abusing, which is really fascinating. And they don't tend to become addicted or dependent upon the hallucinogens as well. So it gets to the what are the circuits that are changing, right, and what's changing with these people, that the addicting drugs that they were so dependent and so hooked on are no longer so compelling to them.
Mm. I wonder, what are the ways in which psilocybin as a medical treatment would differ from recreational use?
So this is a really great question. So the psilocybin is found in, as I mentioned, a variety of different kinds of mushrooms. There are now two companies that are pursuing developing psilocybin for FDA approval as an actual drug. And so each of these companies has patented a way of synthesizing psilocybin in a lab. So they're not taking mushrooms and soaking them and just taking the psilocybin out. They're starting from chemicals in the lab and building blocks using organic chemistry to make psilocybin, and they each have a patent on how to synthesize it. And the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has given approval to fast-track the development of psilocybin for treatment of depression. And so there's two companies that are pursuing that, and it's a really exciting moment because this drug that's currently Schedule 1 through the FDA, which means drugs that cannot be prescribed for any indication, they're thought not to have any medical use of any kind, and they're highly illegal. Now, it's possible under very highly controlled research settings, in such settings, to actually do research on these drugs. So we have a purified drug. It's the active component of what's in the mushroom, and it's produced in the lab, and then we give it to people in a very highly controlled setting and see how it works on their symptoms.
I mean, it would be interesting to hear a little bit about how do you facilitate or foster an environment within the research setting that might be similar or usher in some of the things that have been powerful for people who might go to a healer or a guru.
Yeah, how do you make sure somebody has a good trip? That's what I
wonder
about.
Right, right. That's a great question because we're working in a hospital. It's a beautiful facility. It's really modern and nice and wonderful, but it's a hospital. It has an institutional feel to it. And so actually that was one of the challenges in setting up our site for the study, which is we found a room in what's called the Biological Studies Unit, which is a very quiet corner of the building. and we were assigned a room to use, and we took over the room, and we put in comfortable kind of bed with some bolsters, pillows, a couple of comfortable chairs. There's carpeting on the floor. There's nice calming pictures on the walls, and we have blinds that you know keep excess of light out, and then so it's very comfortable. It looks kind of like a sort of nice hotel room as opposed to a lab. And when the subjects are in the room, we actually turn the lights out in the hallway and have electric candles lighting the way to the bathroom, because we don't have a bathroom in the suite itself, which would have actually been better. And that's very quiet end of the hallway. And then for the duration of the time the person's having their trip, they're in this quiet room, and they are wearing very comfortable eye shades, and then they have very high-end earphones on, and they're playing a playlist that each of the two companies that are pursuing this has their own patented playlist of calming.
What kind of music is it?
You know, it's kind of new agey, sort of what you would have at a spa kind of thing.
Okay.
It's not everybody's cup of tea, but nobody's asked for heavy metal yet, you know?
Yet. Do you guys happen to have diffusers in your room?
Like scents? Like a different scent?
We don't have no.
I only ask because I'm like thinking I might have actually stumbled into one of your study offices, and I was like, where did I just
land? How did you do that?
There's actually a young man I work with, is a patient of mine, and he gets long acting medication, and I sometimes administer it for him, and we couldn't find a room to use.
Oh.
And we stumbled across this beautiful, probably the most beautiful room in the psychiatric institute.
Okay,
but perhaps it wasn't yours because you don't have diffusers.
Don't tell anybody where it is.
Okay.
but it's really important to keep a calm atmosphere, and it's you know a number of the like there are in other countries, there are places that are more spa like that. Provide, you know, in countries where it's not illegal to have use of these drugs, and they tend to be kind of more bucolic, kind of spa-like types of settings. And probably the environment has some impact. The people who've gone through our studies, if you read the reports of what people who trip on these drugs typically report, they often report feeling one with nature. And we haven't had too many reports of feeling one with nature in our subjects yet, although we've had a lot of people describe feeling much more connected to other people, which is, to me, even more interesting, sort of more empathic connection to people in people who are very withdrawn and kind of emotionally detached.
Does anybody observe them, the subjects in your research
study? Oh, so get back to that. So during the course of the trip, we have two psychologists, PhD psychologists in the room, and they're highly trained to help accompany the people through the trip.
Mm-hmm.
So they have met with the subject a couple times before and sort of oriented them. The subject was in the room for a couple hours the day before having their trip. And then they're there. The therapists are there in the room with them for that eight-hour period. And then they meet with them afterwards to help them kind of process what did you experience. And so that's, I think, a key aspect of it as well, which is to help, if the circuits of the brain are kind of getting jumbled up a little bit and new connections are starting to grow, to have a therapist who can help the person work through and address some of the issues that you know, because sometimes people will re-experience traumas. That can be very upsetting. And what do you do with those feelings that may have been buried for a long time? Or if it's positive experience, connection to other people, how do you use that in your life to make more positive connections to people that you might have cut off contact with when you were depressed or couldn't really function very well. So the therapist piece is really, I think, key.
So how long do we think these effects last? It sounds like you have maybe one or two kind of trips, and that's the treatment, right? It's not something that you do
repeatedly. So that's one of the fascinating things about the psychedelics. And actually, we have to, there's so much expectation and hope and hype about psychedelics, it's really important to kind of limit people's expectations. So that's a qualifier when you kind of think about this. Because if you look at the literature, it is one and sometimes two psychedelic treatments and several months of response. And there mm-hmm. was just a paper that came out looking at the cancer, people with cancer depression related to end-of-life issues, and it looked at them several years later, and they still were not depressed. So the studies that have been done mostly have looked at up to a six-month period.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but we don't really know. And I think the key thing is, it's like any new drug. We don't just give one dose of Prozac. We don't just give one psychotherapy session. We don't just give one infusion of ketamine or some of the new treatments. People tend to often have more than one. And so we don't know how many treatments do you need with different conditions to get the person out of the disorder, to stay out of the disorder. If you look at the communities of people who communicate online about these, their self-treatments and sort of homemade treatments and underground treatments, there are people who would get another treatment every 6 months or so. And sort of that might be a booster that would help them stay out of the depression. But we don't really know. And so I think that my other, I guess, really important point would be, this is a time to do really, really good clinical trials. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much expectation, there's so much hope, there's so much hype, fantasy, whatever, and we really have to be grounded. We have to do excellent, high, well-conducted clinical trials to really see what does and doesn't work and compare medicine to placebo and really try to figure out the separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, I actually wanted to hear sort of your thoughts about the social political context and how it either informs the questions people ask, or are there any sort of barriers that you feel like persist in being able to do some of this important work?
There's many barriers. It took us over a year to get started because I had to get my DEA Schedule I license, and we had to prove that we had a storage facility that was secure. We have a locked pharmacy, a locked vault, a locked safe in the locked vault. The safe has two keys, one for me and one for the pharmacist. And my joke is always, it's sort of like Ocean's 11. The only thing we don't have is the acrobats in their leotards and the lasers. But it's very secure. And that's a good obstacle because you don't want these drugs to be diverted. You need to have a trained team. You need to have the room like we talked about. But more than that, that's the setting up the environment and the team. We need funding. You need to develop funding sources. The National Institute of Health does not support funding for this kind of research at this moment. So it tends to be through philanthropy and donors. And there are a few foundations that are providing funding. Pharma, the drug industry, is not interested, the big drug industry. And so the little companies that are supporting it are tend to be mom-and-pop kinds of companies. So there's a need to get funding, to do good research, to set up teams, to do the treatment, to train therapists properly. So it's a startup mentality.
Yeah.
One thing you mentioned was that a lot of people go online to read more about psychedelics and might even be doing kind of their own experiments on themselves. One thing that I've read about online is microdosing. I was wondering if are there any research studies about that?
Or do you know anything about that? Sure, glad to answer that. I would say the self-treatment from online sources really scares me, because having treated about 10 people so far with psychedelic dose of these drugs, with people who have severe treatment-resistant depression, it takes a very high level of clinical expertise. It's not for the faint-hearted. It's not to do recreationally. It's a pretty scary. I think the upside hopefully will be good, but it's not something that people just say, "Oh, I'm depressed, so let me go get some mushrooms." I would really caution people not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Microdose. So that's a really interesting field in itself. So what I've been describing so far is the big psychedelic dose would be, say, 25 milligrams of psilocybin. A microdose might be 1 milligram or 3 milligrams. Mm-hmm. So it's about a tenth or a 20th of the psychedelic dose. And there's
homeopathic dosing.
It's not homeopathic. Well, that's the question. Is it homeopathic? Does it actually do anything? Mm-hmm. And so there's researchers, mostly in Europe, who've looked at mostly LSD, but which is comparable to psilocybin, microdosing, and given it to healthy people, and to look at the effects on performance and attention and problem solving, and also looking at safety issues. So it doesn't seem like it's a placebo or homeopathic dose. Mm. It looks like it has effects. The thing that we're interested in is, can it be used in at Columbia, can it be used to treat people with psychiatric disorders? So attention deficit disorder would be interesting to study. Depression would be interesting to study. And so we're actually putting together a proposal to try to do a microdose study. That comes with its own challenges. The way the microdoses are given is tends to be the tenth of a dose and usually every 3 or 4 days. So people will take these small doses on an ongoing basis, and not every day like a Prozac kind of drug, but it would be probably twice a week in a very small dose. And so there's real challenges. Is that safe? Mm-hmm. And can people actually do that without having other problems or, you know, risks? And what if they're driving or taking care of kids or whatever? And so there's a lot of safety issues. But then beyond that, does it work? Is that a potential way to treat depression or attention deficit disorder? And it could be another alternative to the drugs and therapies that we already have.
What do we know about long-term effects as far as side effects?
So that's being actively looked at this point. And should be done really rigorously using the, you know, for the FDA requires collection of safety data to develop the drugs and to follow them over time. And they seem pretty safe if they're given in controlled settings.
And that's kind of a big if, because there are people out there who I think are trying to self-treat.
Right.
But it sounds so, like you recommend strongly against
that. I just think that it's so risky for people with serious psychiatric diagnoses. And so that's, recreational use, it's obviously widespread. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can necessarily draw conclusions that someone who doesn't have a psychiatric diagnosis and their experience from the person who does have a psychiatric diagnosis, and that's where it's really, I think, apples and oranges. But one example would be suicide. Again, you read about bad trips and people trying or committing suicide when they're having a bad trip. You could also think, though, that hallucinogens might be a good treatment for people who are suicidal, because they disrupt some of these circuits, or we think they do, and people who are suicidal may have activity of certain circuits that make them have negative thoughts, wanting to hurt or kill themselves. If you can disrupt those circuits, you might make the person free of those suicidal thoughts. So is that a safe thing to do? Does it help those people? Does it not help those people? It's a very serious and important public health problem. And if it helps, that would be great. If it makes people more suicidal, that would be a big risk and could limit the use of these drugs a lot.
Yeah,
we'd have to carefully study them in a very kind of controlled setting if we were to evaluate
I think really good clinical trials, it gets back to that, which is really treating people with highly controlled settings and monitoring and asking them to report symptoms and side effects and after effects. And then you can separate out what helps or what hurts.
Right. I have one more question I was just thinking about. Can psilocybin or the other hallucinogens cause like what we call a substance-induced mood disorder or anxiety disorder? There are some other drugs that can cause a psychiatric disorder that wasn't there or precipitate one. Is that possible?
I think that's a good question. I mean, if there's disruption of circuits, how do you know the circuits are going to be disrupted in a way that's useful?
But if there's a bad circuit,
people worse. So I think there's people with certain diagnoses that you would not want to treat with these drugs. So someone who has a schizophrenia, for instance, or who has bipolar disorder, or who has certain kinds of borderline personality or other kinds of personality disorders might have a reaction to that could make them worse rather than better.
And what about anxiety disorders? Because I think when I think of a bad trip, I think of like bad anxiety.
I think that's a good question. I mean, there's certainly people can have intense anxiety or all kinds of intense emotions during and after the trip. And but the, for instance, one measure would be when people are having the drug administration for the study, how many of them need anti-anxiety medicines to be given to them during the study. And my understanding is, in this study so far, nobody's needed it. And so this is across 20 different sites. You know, many dozens of people have been treated. But that's just one measure. But that's an important thing. Does it make you better or worse? And what are the things you have to watch out for? Especially since if the symptoms that someone had from years ago have been suppressed and come back out, to help them process those feelings, they might feel worse before they feel better.
Which can happen in psychotherapy too.
It's very true.
So we just want to say thank you so much for joining us. I think that one of the big takeaway points is that you have to do the research and you have to ask the questions in a particular kind of way so that we can have more information about, you know, what this is really involving and what the risk and potential benefits are. And it sounds tremendously promising. So thank you for the work that you do.
Well, thank you for having me. I think the research, it's also on how do these drugs work. And so the brain imaging and other ways of testing in the brain, because we're just at the infancy of that. And then finding drugs that maybe would have the same benefit without necessarily causing a psychedelic experience. Is that even necessary in order for them to work?
Right.
So we're at the infancy of a really amazing, I think, era to try to understand this whole class of medications.
Absolutely.
It's an exciting time.
It is.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Breakthrough Session. We'll see you next time.